Hi, this is Justin Lannan with Rocket Talk, the Tor.com podcast. I am joined by Irene Gallo of Tor.com, Carl Engel Laird of Tor.com, and Liz Burke of Tor.com, and her own blog as well. So we are here today to talk about the Hugo Awards and what I will call a special episode of Rocket Talk, our first ever special episode. So welcome, everybody. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to go through the ballot. We've got a lot of different categories here on the Hugo ballot. But first, I think we should just make a recognition that in 1939, there were some books released and some random works of fan work, apparently, that we have decided to have an entire ballot for of the 1939 Retro Hugo Awards. Has anybody had a chance to take a look at this ballot and seen what they think? What about you, Liz? You got any thoughts?
What, on the Retro Hugos?
Yes.
I have absolutely no thoughts at all whatsoever. That was a long time before I was reading anything.
I've read The Sword and the Stone. It was kind of formative to me. Beyond that, I don't really... Beyond that, I don't really have a horse in this race.
Do we have a woman nominated for Best Novel? I don't think so. It's Edgar Rice Burroughs, E.E. Smith, Jack Williamson, C.S. Lewis, and T.H. White.
We have a woman nominated for Best Novella.
We certainly do. Anne Rand with Anthem. Has anybody here read Anthem?
I have not.
I have.
I've spent more time avoiding Anne Rand than looking for her stuff. So
I have to admit, I had a brief period in college where I actually read everything she wrote, which was an interesting. Well, not everything she wrote, all of the fiction that she wrote, which was an interesting experience that I look back on with various degrees of horror and amazement. So,
I think a lot of people go through that kind of phase.
Now, given that we've had this interesting incursion of Hugo ballots, you might say, which we'll get to in just a minute, I wonder if that will boost Anne Rand's chance at a Hugo. What do you think, Irene? You think she's got a better chance now that we have some new voters in the pool?
I suppose so. Unfortunately, I really don't pay much attention to the Retro Hugos, so I'm not going to be a good judge here.
Have we had Retro Hugos before, or is this the first time?
No, I think they've been going on for a couple of years now.
Huh. Well, news to me. All right. So that's the Retro Hugos, everybody. We'll see what happens. I think total numbers of nominating ballots were only 208 for novel. And as you get down the ballot, I think we had, 42 ballots for fanzine. So clearly not a lot of people are really, really invested here. So anyway, on to the actual Hugo ballot, which is the 2013 novels in the 2014 Hugo Awards. And we're going to start with best novel. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the candidates that are on the shortlist, and then we'll talk about them. So best novel is Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, published by Orbit in the US and the UK. Neptune's Brood by Charles Stross, published by Ace in the US and Orbit in the UK. Parasite by Mira Grant, Orbit in US and UK. Warbound, book 3 of the Grim Noir Chronicles, by Larry Correa with Bain Books, and The Wheel of Time by Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson by Tor Books in the United States and Orbit in the United Kingdom. So, let's go to Liz first. What do you think about this slate, Liz?
Well, I've read about four-fifths of it. Not quite four-fifths, because I haven't read A Memory of Light yet. And I haven't read Larry Correa's book either. I did get 20 pages into his first novel. But I think that it's probably going to be... it's a difficult one to call, because The Wheel of Time has an awful lot of support. And Ancillary Justice and Neptune's Brood and Parasite are all definite would all definitely be contenders. But they're very... It's sort of like having a... Sort of like comparing apples with a giant marshmallow, really, to have a series the length of The Wheel of Time up against your regular novel.
Yeah, it really is kind of unprecedented, Carl. I mean, we've certainly never seen anything like this before. How do you even begin to handicap something like this, where you're looking at a 14 or 13 book series against, what is essentially a debut novel?
So I've had a number of people reacting to this news with a sense of kind of unfairness. Like, why is it fair to pit one book against 14? And my response to most of them has been that I think it's probably unfair in the other direction. A lot of people who've read The Wheel of Time, obviously. but not as many people have been thinking about it as a best novel for as long. And there's a lot that can happen over the course of 14 books that can turn people off. I'll say that. So yeah, I like Ancillary Justice in this category.
I would have thought it was a shoe-in until, I think, recently. I'm starting to think maybe not quite as much. But I do think, you know, with the ranked system, I think for as many people are going to want to vote against the Wheel of Time just on principle as they will, going to want, you know, as they are Wheel of Time fans that'll vote for it. So I do wonder how this is going to play out. I think it is more of a horse race than I thought it would be. I thought it was going to be Ancillary Justice just from the get-go.
Can I say just how excited I am to see Ancillary Justice on that ballot?
Yes, absolutely.
Because
yeah.
it's a debut novel, and I don't know how many debut novels have hit the Hugo award list, but I can't think that it's an overwhelming number. And for a novel that's having such an interesting conversation about what makes a person, about gender, about colonialism, about artificial intelligence, about personhood on the ballot, it's really exciting for me to see that there.
I agree with you, Liz. I think it's a fantastic novel, and it does all of those things. And I think the novel I would compare it most closely to and from sort of past ballots would be Paolo Bacigalupi's Wind Up Girl. I mean, they don't really deal with some of the same kinds of themes, obviously, but I think that in terms of where the novel came from, how it kind of came out of nowhere, it sort of became something of the zeitgeist, I think that's probably the best comparison point. And of course, Bacigalupi's novel went on to win the Hugo that year and sort of launched what has become one of the more quick rises in our publishing community in a long time. So I thought Ancillary Justice was going to be a slam dunk on this initially, and then The Wheel of Time being on here. I think also the news today that was announced that Tor will be including all of the books in the Hugo packet will in some ways drive up the votership for that, not necessarily because people will read it, but because people who would like to archive those books will now be more likely to join the ballot. I know, you know, I've certainly read The Wheel of Time many times, but I don't actually have any of the ebooks. I'm actually going to be really excited to get all those ebooks, and I think we'll see a lot of people do that.
I wonder how many people that buy a membership just to get the downloads that will follow through and actually vote. I don't know. Some will, obviously. Yeah.
I hope that more people who are encouraged to get supporting memberships for this particular reason read but don't necessarily vote if they weren't going to anyway.
I think that would be a strange incentive. Yeah.
Can I also say that I'm really happy to see Neptune's Brood on the ballot. I mean, I don't think it's Charles Stross's best novel, but it's one of those big idea sci-fi novels that, you know, basically belongs on the award list.
Personally, I really struggle with a novel. I've not read Neptune's Brood, nor have I read Saturn's Children. And I don't know how much of a sequel it is, but I do know it is in a series with Saturn's Children. And I always struggle with secondary books in a series being on an awards ballot.
It's not even a series novel. It's a second novel in the same universe. That's pretty much its only point of contact.
Well, wonderful. That means I can read it and judge it on its own merits, which will be wonderful. I love
that. I'm very glad to hear that as well.
That re-brings up the series idea, though. I mean, for an industry that's so based around series and trilogies and everything, you know, it is, you know, is there room for a series award? Probably not quite, but clearly Wheel of Time is going to bring up the discussion of that.
Oh, God bless Irene Gallo right now in New York City. I love the sirens in the background. It's no podcasts are just never complete without that. The one thing I'll say is that based on this series rule, I know that myself and a few other people are already kind of talking about a great desire to see Elizabeth Baer's series being discussed this way next year.
Yes.
Because the Eternal Sky trilogy, I believe, is what it's called.
Yeah,
it's absolutely worthy of that kind of recognition. So I hope that some people think about that. Before we get onto the next category, I think now is probably a pretty good time to just get this out of the way. Warbound Book 3 of the Grim Noir Chronicles is part of what we call the Sad Puppy Ballad, which was put forth by Larry Correa and Vox Day on their blogs and urging their supporters and followers to vote a certain slate. And this novel was on that slate. What do you think about this, Liz? Is this a strange blip, or is this something wrong with the system? What do you think?
The Hugo Awards, it's an award by popular vote, so it's always going to be open to people promote. I mean, the odd thing about this year is that it there's a definite political divide down the vote. I mean, I have not read many of the entries in the Sad Puppy Ballot, but it's sort of it's persuasively, you know, a political push, as opposed to necessarily, you know, these are the things that I read and loved. You might consider them. I mean, Korea's Town has just basically been let's stick it to people, which I find a rather off-putting, personally.
It's definitely it is the system, you know. It is a popular vote, and I think nobody has to like it. And certainly, there are nominees here that I don't like, but I don't think it's invalid. I don't think it makes the rest of the list invalid. I think it's a remarkable list. I think there's so much good stuff on the list this year, and I just hope that everybody votes the way they feel.
Yeah, I mean, some people have been saying that, oh, the Hugo Award is broken. It's no more broken than any other system on a popular
exactly.
vote.
Exactly, yeah.
We can argue that. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just saying, there's certainly people in our government that I wish weren't there, but, you know, we voted them in, and then we got to live with that as well. So, you know, I could certainly live with it on the Hugo nominations.
Yeah, we can argue about how broken a system by popular vote is. I think the only thing that most people agree on is that... And on the other system is likely to be worse.
And we have other systems. There is the Locus Awards. There is the World Fantasy. There is the Nebulas. And I'm glad for all of them and all the points of view that they bring. This is the popular vote one, and that's interesting and fun in its own way.
Yeah, I wasn't speaking about the awards necessarily on the popular vote. I was talking politics, but the award system is. There's such a diversity of awards in the sort of genre community. So,
the fact that although we don't necessarily like the point of view of Sad Puppy Ballots or the people that are pushing the folks on that ballot, you know, the reality is that we have lots of folks on this ballot this year that were advocated by others, you know, rather vociferously, and certainly, you know, Mira Grant appearing on the Best Novel list for the fourth straight year, you know, across two series and you know, four books and. I think it clearly shows that she has a really strong group of supporters that are backing her, and you know, not to say that she's asked them in the same way that these other folks have, but it just demonstrates that there are absolutely groups of folks out there that are voting a certain way based on a certain point of view. And in this case, we're really not a fan of the point of view, but but it sort of is what it is, and I think we can really get angry about the point of view, but maybe not necessarily about the way the system works.
Yeah,
absolutely.
We can see how it falls out. A lot of the damage that this could potentially bring about in either direction, if there are two directions here, will be reduced by the, you know, preferential voting system with the instant runoffs and things like that. I think that the Hugo system is, for a popularity contest, probably surprisingly robust against this kind of thing. We can hope.
Well, right, because of the nature of the ballot, and for those that don't know, the way it works is, you know, they first add up all the first place ballots, and whoever puts them as number one, they sort them, and if nobody has 50%, then they eliminate the fifth person, and they go to that fifth ballot's down ballot. So it really does prevent somebody from getting 20% of the first place votes and suddenly finding themselves with a Hugo. So I think you're right, Carl. I think that will certainly mitigate some of this. A concern of a small minority driving the ship. All right, well, that's Best Novel. Just real quick, let's go around and just prediction. Who's going to win? Liz.
My vote is... Well, my bet is split between The Wheel of Time and Ancillary Justice.
Well, I need you to pick one.
I think that... I'm not going to pick one.
What do you think's going to win, Carl?
Well, I don't want to say for sure until I've read as much of the list as I'm going to. I think that Ancillary Justice will win. I'm just not sure how I'm going to vote yet.
That's fair.
I'm going to say the same thing.
Okay. I agree.
Think it has a good chance, yeah.
I think I would very much like Ancillary Justice to win. I think ultimately The Wheel of Time will win, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, given how significant that piece of work is to the place that our genre finds itself at today. So, with that, best novella. We have The Butcher of Cardiff by Dan Wells, The Chaplain's Legacy by Brad Torgerson, Equoid by Charles Stross, Six Gun Snow White by Catherine Valenti, and Wakula Springs by Andy Duncan and Ellen Klages. Has anybody read any of these yet?
I have read Equoid, Wakula Springs, because I formatted both of them for the website, and I'm about 80% of the way through Six Gun Snow White, which I started yesterday. I look forward to reading all of them, but those are the ones I had read and most wanted to read.
Yeah, I'm also hoping to read all of them. I've not, unfortunately, read any of them. Although I'll tell you, I am always looking forward to a Kat Valenti story. I think her prose is some of the best in the biz, as they say. Liz, have you read any of these?
I've read Equoid, and I got about halfway through Wakula Springs. It's not really my kind of story.
Well, it's not very speculative, is it?
Not much.
No, I mean, I like it, but these days I have so much else to read that if something doesn't grab me, I tend not to finish it.
I think that Wakula Springs is an excellent example of a kind of magical realism, but one that actually tends on the side of realism rather than magic. So while it's surprising to see it on this ballot, and also this is multiply nominated, it and Six Gun Snow White are both also on the Nebulas, I think there will be a lot of people who take issue with it because it's not speculative. It's an excellent story, though. Really very strong.
Well, Andy Duncan and Ellen Klages are obviously two of the sort of luminaries of the short fiction world, right? So it's sort of no surprise that that it's as good as it is. I do think it's interesting that The Butcher of Cardiff and Chaplain's Legacy, again, were part of that that group ballot that were put forth by those folks. And it'll be very interesting to see what 4 and 5 were, or rather 6 and 7 were, the ones that just missed. And that'll be interested down the ballot as we go through folks that made the ballot through that slate that kind of went up at the last minute.
One of my favorites from Tor.com last year was Burning Girls, and I was a little sad to see it not make the list. So if that is 5 or 6, I'll shed a tear.
Who wrote that?
Veronica Shanos.
Okay. Well, we'll see. I don't have a pick here. I mean, if I had to guess, I would guess Kat Valenti because she just seems to do very well with the Hugo crowd. But that's just purely based on the way I handicap these things. I no vote on quality at that point. Any other thoughts?
I think you're right, although Wakula Springs does have a really nice, sort of fan base, it seems. And Charlie Stross is always very popular, so I think this is a horse race.
Best novelette. We have Opera Vita Eterna by Vox Day, The Exchange Officers by Brad Torgerson, The Lady Astronaut of Mars by Mary Robinette Cole, The Truth of Facts, The Truth of Feeling by Ted Chiang, and The Waiting Stars by Aliette Devaudard. I'll just mention here, for those that don't remember, The Lady Astronaut of Mars was a controversial Hugo thing last year when it was actually nominated and then ruled ineligible because it was only published via audio, and it was ruled that it was not a novelette and was actually a best dramatic presentation short form. What do you think, Irene? What did you think about that whole thing, that whole ruled ineligible bit last year? It's kind of strange, right?
It was very strange, but I was also sort of glad that, we could sort of react to it and were able to give it a home. But yeah, no, it must have been heartbreaking for Mary to see that on the night of the Hugos.
It was that late?
Yeah, she found out that evening.
I did not realize it happened that late. That is really heartbreaking.
Right, if you're nominated and then they ask you about it, they tell you about it, and then it's discovered to be ineligible, obviously you know about it. That often happens with the Campbell Award, where they find out somebody has a short fiction publication from in the past, and so they don't know about it. But if you are just ruled ineligible because of the way the voting breaks down, you don't know about it until those stats come out.
Yeah.
Which is kind of bizarre. So, anyway, have you read any of these other ones yet, Carl?
I've read Lady Astronaut of Mars. I'm most of the way through The Truth of Fact, The Truth of Feeling. I was having a bit of trouble getting all the way through it. I've never actually... The first time I tried to read Ted Chiang, I bounced. I'm doing better this time, but I'm going to have to pick it back up again later.
What about you, Liz? Have you seen any of these yet?
I've read The Lady Astronaut of Mars and The Truth of Fact, The Truth of Feeling, and the first paragraph of Opera Vita Eterna.
Thank you for that excellent pronunciation. It was much better than mine.
Sorry, I came up from classicists. They would punch me in the face if I mispronounced Latin. I haven't read The Waiting Stars, but I am looking forward to reading it because Elliot de Bodard consistently blows me away in short fiction.
Yeah, she's had a really good couple of years, hasn't she? I think she was on here last year, maybe with two stories last year on different categories. I may be wrong.
I think she definitely had a novella in. I'm not sure.
She was certainly on the Nebulas in more than one category.
Yeah. Well, I guess the big question here is, anybody going to read the Vox Day story?
No, I am not.
Not even if it's free in the packet?
I mean, it will be free in the packet.
Right.
I'm sure I could find it now if I wanted to. But
I won't.
I have considered reading it, and I was even considering reading it, actually taking that story and putting it on, like, Indiegogo or something and doing, like, a little fundraiser for an LGBT charity if I, you know, write some excoriating review with, like, upsell things where, like, Liz will come in and write a review and then Fosmetos will come in and write a review.
Justin, stop stealing my idea!
Somebody needs to do it. Somebody needs to do that. That'd be fantastic. Anyway.
Because I was talking about doing that with Stefan Reitz just, like, 2 hours ago.
Oh, that's funny, because Jenny Thurman and I were talking about it yesterday. That's funny.
It sounds great. Like you have a groundswell.
Yeah, great minds. Yeah, really. Like,
yeah, but based on the first paragraph, it's it won't, if I read it even aside from Vox Day's politics, based on the first paragraph, it's not going to rank above Noah Ward.
All right, so I'm going to venture a guess here that if I was guessing, the Lady Astronaut of Mars will win only because of the what happened last year will sort of raise the profile of it. But that's just a hunch, obviously. Ted Chiang has an enormous following. So does Aliette de Bodard. So who knows?
I don't think Ted Chiang's story is his strongest one ever. To be honest, I found the truth of feeling quite not very compelling personally. But then again, my taste in short fiction, when I actually manage to read short fiction, almost never lines up with Audwin's awards.
I'm one of those bizarre people that I love short fiction, but I'm an under 5,000 word short fiction person. When I read short fiction, I want it to be short. And that's just, I was talking to Jason Heller from the AV Club about this the other day, and we were both in agreement that, like, the shorter the better when it comes to short fiction. That's just kind of my thing. I know some people love the novelette length, and they just think it's a great length for a story. I actually hear that from a lot of the short fiction editors. But for me, it's that short story. That's the one I like. All right, so best short story. If You Were a Dinosaur, My Love by Rachel Swirsky. The Ink Readers of Doi Saket by Thomas Older Hoifelt. Selkie Stories Are for Losers by Sophia Samatar. And The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere by John Chu. Carl, I think I heard you mention earlier you have read all of these.
I have. They're all available online. So
you didn't buy any of these, did you? You were not the commissioning editor on any of those Tor.com stuff.
No.
Okay.
My first story came out in March.
All right.
So I didn't have anything out in 2013.
Then you were unbiased, and you may proceed.
Oh, I was not at all unbiased. I campaigned hard in-house for The Water That Falls to get in our best of for the year. And it's the story that is on my heart's ballot. But, like, I did read the other two, and if I had been biased, it's impossible. These stories are amazing, and they all bring out something strong and different from the medium. I think, I don't have the numbers on hand, but I bet The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere is the longest and has the longest development of a story, whereas If You Were a Dinosaur is really, really short and packs a huge amount of emotion into a very compressed space.
Well, that's one of the things I want to ask, and I wonder if Irene has thought about this. I find that short stories, that sort of 5,000 and under range, is a range where the emotional impact always seems stronger, and I think it's because you don't have a lot of time to sort of gather yourself as a reader emotionally. I mean, I always find myself much more rocked by a short story than I ever am by a novel or anything else longer than that.
I think it has to do so much in a little bit of time. Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, that it just packs a lot of punch and, you know, very quickly. Doesn't have room to sort of ramble on a bit, and I appreciate it for that.
Yeah. I mean, I just read the four of them this afternoon. And Silky Stories Are for Losers, that last line just whacks you. So it's the same with If You Were a Dinosaur, My Love. And The Water That Falls on You from Nowhere, that the emotional impact comes up to the sharpest possible point in the last lines, the final paragraphs, which you don't really get in longer forms, I don't think.
Yeah, it's almost unique to short fiction. It's like that. It's almost like the punchline in a comedy routine. They have the ability to just get it. I don't know. It's one of those things. I always consider myself a very savvy short story reader because I don't read any of them until the best novel ballots come out or the best ballots come out. And I say
so that, you necessarily have good taste?
Well, it's one of those things where there's so much of it published every year that I feel like if I tried to keep up with it throughout the year, I would soon be buried under it and would have no concept of what I had read by the end of the year just because there's so much of it. So I always kind of binge read between now and August.
That is a shame of the 5% requirement here that we only have with a list that's this strong. I would love to know what the fifth story was. You know, it's so I'm curious.
This is the second year in a row that the 5% rule.
Yeah,
we only had three last year, right?
Is that true?
Yeah.
It was a Ken Liu, Kit Johnson. There we go. Kit Johnson was one, and then there was a third, but it was only the three of them, I believe. And
the third was the third was Immersion by Aliette de Bodard.
Yes, Aliette.
So, you know, I think it's a bummer, but I think what it actually demonstrates, Irene, for good, is that there's a... You know what? We have not sworn on Tor.com yet, despite having an expletive tag. So there is a shitload of magazines out there, online and offline, that are publishing short stories these days, and there is just so much. I mean, if you go down here and we get to the semi-prozine, and you see Lightspeed and Strange Horizons and Apex and Inner Zone, and that's not even counting Clark's World, which is now a professional zine, and Tor.com, which is a professional zine, and all of these others, there's so much out there.
All these themed anthologies.
I think you're just seeing a fracturing where there's how do you actually have an organized vote that's enough? You know, with 865 nominating ballots, doing some very rough math, you need about 45 nominations to meet that 5% rule. And the reality is getting 45 people to agree on what the best short story of the year is like trying to get them to agree on, you know, what you're going to have for dinner. It's like impossible. I guess that's probably what's going on here. Any favorites? Anybody got a prediction?
I am in the end shamefacedly biased, but it is so close in quality and impact. It is so close.
I think this is going to be Sophia Samatar's year. I mean, Selkie Stories Are for Losers is on the BSFA ballot as well. And lost that to Nina Ellen's Spin, which I'm kind of surprised not to see on the Hugo list, actually. A lot of people were talking it up. But I'm going to say that Selkie Stories Are for Losers is my favorite, and I think it's the one that's most likely to take it home.
I think this could be the first place where we see a UK impact on the ballot. And that's because this was published for Strange Horizons. I think we're going to see perhaps maybe the UK vote put itself there just because of the huge UK component to Strange Horizons. That's just a...
Strange Horizons is really international, though, so...
They are, which again, I think would sort of help the fact that it's in London this year, so...
I think this is a case whoever wins, you just can't begrudge it. I think, I won't say who I think is going to win, but I think it's such a winning ballot.
So, the next category, which I will have to bow out from slightly, is Best Related Work. And we have Queers Dig Time Lords, a celebration of Doctor Who by the LGBTQ fans who love it, edited by Sigrid Ellis and Michael Damian Thomas. Speculative Fiction 2012, the best online reviews, essays, and commentary, edited by me and Jared Shuren. We Have Always Fought, challenging the women, cattle, and slaves narrative by Cameron Hurley, published on the blog A Dribble of Ink. Wonder Book, The Illustrated Guide to Creating Imaginative Fiction by Jeff Vandermeer with Jeremy Zerfoss. And Writing Excuses, Season 8, Sanderson Wells, Kowal, Taylor, and Sanderson. Has anybody had an opportunity to consume much of this? I think, Liz, you've seen a lot of it.
I actually haven't. It's the only ones I'm remotely familiar with are Specfic 2012, We Have Always Fought. I've seen the excerpt from Wonder Book that was in the BSFA nominees handbook, and it looks absolutely fantastic. From a writer's perspective, can we just say how madly different disparate the entries in this category are this year. It's like you've got two separate, completely different collections, a blog post, a book about writing fiction, and a podcast, which is also about writing fiction. But there's so many different media doing so many different things in this category this year. It's mad, it's crazy, and I think I love it.
I don't usually pay much attention to the related work category, and this just looks fantastic. You know, there's everything on here is something I either know a little bit about already or want to, you know, check out more in the upcoming months.
What about you, Carl?
I have read of this only We Have Always Fought, which was a fantastic essay.
Yeah, that was remarkable.
It was very, very powerful. What I noticed looking at this ballot is there's a lot of overlap with last year, actually, for a, you know, five entry thing. Writing Excuses won last year, and there were two entries from Mad Norwegian Press, the people who put out Queer as Dick Time Lords. So I'm interested to see what the Writing Excuses team do with being renominated after winning.
Yeah, I mean, I had kind of expected them to do sort of like what Squeecast did, which was stepping aside, given the professional nature of all of the people involved with it, and they're just huge fan base. Obviously, Sanderson, Wells, Kowal, Taylor, those are just enormous fan bases. Mm-hmm. We'll see. I mean, obviously they've accepted the nomination, so I expect they'll happily win this year if they win, and then we'll see what they do in the future. You know, I think I'm fascinated, Liz, that you said Wonder Book only submitted an excerpt in the BSFA handbook, because I think actually this is a category where the Hugo packet will have a great impact, because I don't think, other than Cameron's essay, just because of its hugely high profile, and Aidan Moher from A Dribble of Ink, who published that essay today, said just on his website alone, he's had 150 unique impressions on that website, on that 150,000 unique impressions on that blog post. And that's only counting his site. It was actually republished in several places. Cameron ended up getting an NPR interview because of it. And I mean, it was really just a hugely successful blog post. And so obviously it's been huge exposure, but I really think what's in the packet will matter a lot for Wonder Book because of its visual value.
I mean, I have to say that Cameron Hurley has been on fire with her sort of commentary writing in the last year. And We Have Always Fought is possibly one of my favorite pieces from the internet from last year, because it's just so on point.
Well, and she has actually talked to somebody about this today, how incredibly talented she is, because there is absolutely very little overlap between fiction writing and essay writing. And I don't think a lot of fiction writers maybe realize that when they sit down to try to write an essay or a blog post, and they're like, oh my God, this is so hard. And Cameron is like equally adept at both. She's just a tremendous essay writer. The narrative shape of that piece is incredible. I will only say that I jokingly said to Cameron on Twitter,
Llamas forever.
Yeah, Llamas forever, right? I joke that if she can't make it, whoever accepts the award on her behalf, if she wins, must dress up as a llama. But I'll just say that I told Cameron jokingly on Twitter today, I said, Cameron, just so you know, a vote for Cameron Hurley's essay is a vote against Cameron Hurley's essay included in the Fic 2012. So I'll just say that.
Okay. Is this the first time a single blog post has been a related work? Is that true? Yeah. Interesting. Yeah.
So it's a cool category. I'm with you, Liz. I'm really excited about how kind of diverse it is and how many different perspectives are in there. So anyway, I think it's a good sign. I think a lot of people are realizing that related work is a category that we can include a lot of different things. And I mean, certainly in the future, Tor.com would absolutely qualify in this category, and I think would be, you know, certainly deserves a nomination at some point in this category.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I'm disappointed that Steel I Span's album Wintersmith didn't get in, but...
But I think that's a classic case of people not realizing that music would be eligible here.
Yes.
And it absolutely is.
It is related.
Yes.
We have to give a shout out to one of our on staff writers, Emily Asher-Perrin, is in Queer as Dig Time Lords. So, yay, Emily.
We're going to skip Best Graphic Story. I think we all recognize that Saga seems to be the favorite here, but Girl Genius is coming back after being off the ballot for a while and used to be the perennial favorite. So we'll see what happens. I'm not going to go through that. None of us have really any thoughts on it. Best Dramatic Presentation Long Form. I think we may have some brief thoughts on this. We have Frozen, Gravity, The Hunger Games Catching Fire, Iron Man 3, and Pacific Rim. Liz, you got any thoughts here?
Well, I've seen all of them except for Gravity, and I'm really looking forward to getting my hands on a DVD of Gravity when I get the time. But it's kind of amazing, because I think this is the first year that the Best Dramatic Presentation long form has had 3.5 films that had a female protagonist. I'm saying Pacific Rim has half. Is the half. But Gravity, The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, Frozen, it warms the cockles of my, you know, hairy-legged feminist heart.
How often, and Frozen is also written by a female author, how often does that happen for dramatic presentation long form? Probably not that often.
How often does it happen in Hollywood?
Yeah.
Well, exactly, right?
No, I think that's a good point. And I'll also point out Frozen is also kind of unique in that, I mean, it obviously does a lot of things new within the Disney formula. You know, it is love sort of saves the day, spoilers, but it's not the love between a man and a woman, or even a romantic love, but sort of this sisterhood. I mean, we talk about the Bechdel test all the time, and it's sort of like a classic example of that. It's about these two sisters and them coming together, and that they can solve their problems together. And I think that was, I know for me, as a father, that was of a daughter, that was a really cool thing to see. And I wish we had more movies that did that.
Also, it has very, very catchy music.
It does have that.
Yeah.
Once you hear it, you can't stop singing it in your head. Maybe that's just me, though.
Irene, would you like to build a snowman?
I have not seen it, which is terrible, because I love the singers in it, and I just have not gotten around to seeing it.
Well, I don't really know how to handicap this. I feel like the huge fanish contingent will kind of go behind Pacific Rim because it's so fanboy friendly. The artsy crowd will go for Gravity, and then, you know, everybody else will go for Frozen. So I don't really know how this one will shake out.
I will say that Pacific Rim has a lot to recommend it beyond just a fanboy contingent.
Yeah.
I'm a big partisan for that film. I don't think it's
It's visually beautiful, even everything else aside.
And beyond that, it also has a truly international and non-white monolithic cast, and is about that in a very real way.
Well, I think the lack of American centrism in it is a very interesting social and political message that I think you can extrapolate from it and kind of point at it as having a film with a point.
How often do you have a giant sort of action apocalypse film that whose major point is cooperation saves the day, not the lone hero? It's kind of the first time I've sort of really seen that.
And the lone hero, when he goes Maverick, gets humbled and actually stays humbled. It's pretty amazing. It bucks a lot of conventions for a giant robot flick. I don't think it's going to win, but it bucks a lot of conventions.
But the robot has a sword, bro.
Secretly, yeah.
And Gravity was not good, so I'll be annoyed if Gravity wins.
Ooh, wow, dissenting voice. I did not expect the first controversy to be Gravity.
Ugh, it was terrible dialogue. I think if you had dubbed the movie, it would have been into some other storyline, it would have been fine. But with that dialogue, it looked gorgeous, obviously. But
yeah,
I haven't seen Pacific Rim and the others. I've Frozen. But I liked Hunger Games.
Yeah. The Hunger Games was a lot of fun.
It was good, but its
problem is that it's a sequel as well, so it's got sequelitis.
It does, it doesn't really end. Yeah, there's no ending to it. Although it's a better movie than the first movie, I think. So that was that. It had that going for it. But if I were to guess, I would think Frozen has this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's gonna be between Frozen and Pacific Rim. I'll be surprised if anything else wins it.
Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form should just be permanently renamed to Doctor Who.
There needs to be a Best Doctor Who category if they want anyone else to win anything Best Dramatic Short Form.
Yeah, that's probably true. It's really frustrating, particularly this year, because at least one of them barely has any speculative elements. It's like a show about a TV show. So I don't know. It's kind of a bizarre anyway. Whatever, we're going to skip it. If you feel passionately about Best Dramatic Presentation Short Form, please excoriate us in the comments for our derisive tone. Best Editor Short Form. We have John Joseph Adams, Neil Clark, Ellen Datlow, Jonathan Strahan, and Sheila Williams. So, interestingly, I'll just start it off with this. Interestingly, John Joseph Adams and Jonathan Strahan, despite being nominated many times, and I believe this is true of Neil Clark as well, have never won this category. All three of them have been nominated many times and have never won. Any thoughts on this, Irene?
Well, this is a tough one because Ellen does so much work for us. It seems sort of nicely split between people that work on anthologies and people work on magazines. That's really my only thought.
Most of the people here are, you know, at the top of very major science fiction, fantasy magazines. So I think that's it. You know, it may not be easy to call, but this is a good survey of the short form field.
Yeah, I don't really read enough short fiction in general to have strong opinions about the editors, except that Clark's World consistently publishes stuff that people keep telling me I have to go and read, so...
I think it's interesting that, you know, Datlow was off the ballot for 3 years after being sort of a perennial on the ballot. I think her last appearance was in 2010, and she's coming back now, and I have to think that's at least partly due to her new affiliation with Tor.com, sort of a reminder to everybody that she's not just, you know, editing horror, which she's also done a lot of, but now she's sort of actively with a magazine or webzine or whatever you want to call it, which may be significant. Interesting, Strahan is not. He's just mostly just an anthology editor, which makes him sort of the interesting, you know, different of the rest of them. And I did hear Jonathan Strahan and Gary K. Wolfe recorded Coot Street the other night, and I was fascinated that they pointed out that this is the first time that the analog editor, I believe, has not been nominated. Or the first time in a really long time. Or is it Asimov's? One of them. I don't know which one Sheila Williams is with. But the other one, it's very unlikely. Because Stan Schmidt is now off the ballot after...
Right. Because he's retired. Yeah.
Right. So that's interesting. So we're all just calling this a coin flip, right?
Yeah.
Coin flip. All right. Best editor long form, Ginger Buchanan. Just recently retired from Ace, Sheila Gilbert at DAW, Liz Gorinsky at Tor Books, Lee Harris at Angry Robot, and Tony Weisskopf at Bane Books. Given that Ginger has just retired, I can almost see this press release writing itself after her 30-year career, iconic career in the field. Is there anybody thinking that she might not win this?
I think that there is a very strong reason to vote for her now. As the only retiring person in a field of otherwise people who seem like they're only going to have more career ahead of them. So that's my take on it.
Yeah, I agree.
Liz? Yeah.
Yeah, I think what's challenging with this category is, of course, how do you vote for it, right? And I do think that's why it kind of becomes somewhat of a career recognition award. I do think it's interesting, Tor has so many editors. I mean, there are, I don't know how many there are. Irene, you probably know exactly how many there are. How many?
Oh my gosh, do I? There's...
It's lots.
More than six. It's about six or seven that are sort of our senior editorial staff. Yeah, is that right? I could run them down. That would bore everybody.
It's hard. It's also like there's a lot of very prolific and excellent editors at the level directly below that. So,
yeah. So there's a lot.
There's a lot.
I mean, I can name probably seven or eight off the top of my head, and I'm sure I don't know all of them. So,
and they're not all in New York. You know, we have full-time, you know, Tor editors that live throughout, you know, various places.
Beth Meacham works remotely, yeah. Right? And yeah. Anyway, I just think it's interesting that Liz Gorinsky has shown up a couple of years in a row, and obviously Patrick Nielsen Hayden has been a mainstay here. So I just think it's interesting that this Tor editor, Liz, stands out over and over again. Who knows why,
yeah.
But she does. Especially because I don't think the voting populace has any idea who edits what, really.
Yeah, I mean, the main thing that... I mean, I didn't nominate in the Best Editor Long Form category this year because it's really an industry award, and I have absolutely no idea who's responsible for most of the books that I read unless the author thanks them directly in the acknowledgements.
It's very difficult to find any record of an editor's editing resume, as it were, or CV. Like, there just isn't a resource that collects those, which I find mildly discouraging, but, you know.
Well, I know what I've done in years past is I usually tend to pick... I only nominate one person in this category every year because I feel like I just pick the press who I think had the best year and I pick the senior most editor who I can find. And so this year I thought Orbit had a great year, so Davey Pillai was my nominator. You know, that's the person I nominated. A couple years ago when Nightshade had their great year where they released all those fantastic debut novels, I said Jeremy Lassen was my editor of the year. And so it's tricky because I just don't really know. I think Lee Harris has done a lot of interesting things at Angry Robot, you know, in terms of sort of trying different
puzzle
solutions.
And it's a UK, you know, event. It'd be nice to see more UK people on the list. But I think Liz is very engaged in the community, and so I think she sort of gives herself a good boost there. I think people have more awareness of what she's doing because she goes to a lot of the conventions. She's online a lot. And so I think that definitely helps out.
Yes, not an editorial recluse.
Yes.
and you're totally right, Irene. It's not a bummer because all of these candidates are certainly running very successful and critically successful and commercially successful lines, but there is only one UK editor on here, and obviously we have a surfeit of UK imprints that aren't recognized here, and I've got who knows why, but anyway. All right, best professional artist. This is where Irene gets to go crazy. We have Galen Dara, Julie Dillon, Daniel Dos Santos, John Harris, John Picasso, and Fiona Staples. Irene?
I don't know if I'm going to go crazy, but it is nice that it's a list with three women on it, and there have been three women in the entire history of the Hugos nominated for Best Pro Artist. So this is a much better year than the entire history of the Hugos for women on the slate. And Galen has had an explosive year, so fantastic for her. Julie has been doing great work for a while now, and again, though, just really seems to have hit a critical mass of awareness, so, you know, great on her. And I don't know Fiona Staples as well. I really don't follow comics very well, but it's, you know, it's great to see another woman on the list. John Harris, I rarely sort of campaign for artists because I work with so many of them and they all do such great work and they do work for, you know, cross publishing and all. But John Harris is somebody who's been doing spectacular and relevant work since like 1980 until today. And really is just as fresh and great today as he was then. So, and it's remarkable to me that he's only been nominated twice, I think, in his career. So I'm also, you know, sort of a big cheerleader for John Harris. Dan DeSantis is always great. John Picasso. So this will be another fun one to watch and really not feel bad for whoever wins.
And Fiona Staples has not done cover work, right? She's strictly comics?
Not that I know of, but again, I don't follow comics. So if she has, she's not a regular on science fiction fantasy book covers. So.
Okay. I'm pretty familiar with all six of these artists and their work. Carl or Liz, do you guys pay attention to this one?
Not really. I mean, the only artist, apart from Picasso, because his name seems to come up almost every year, the only artist that whose work I've actually seen, really, is Julie Dillon's, and that's mostly because she did the interior art in that chapbook that Kate Elliott put out, the Secret Journal of Beatrice Bessie, that tied into her trilogy. But the art was absolutely fantastic, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what is in the Hugo packet.
For most of these, I just did a quick Google search to familiarize myself with the art. I don't follow most of the art scene. I do follow very closely the artists who Irene tends to commission from for Tor.com. So those were all my votes because I like them so much, but I think they're slightly less well-known outside the Tor.com community. But this seems like a really strong set.
This is also nice to see. I mean, this was one of those broken categories for about 20, 25 years where two people basically traded the award back and forth. You had Michael Whalen and Bob Eggleton. And it was nice about maybe 4 or 5 years ago, there was a real effort to unbreak it. And I definitely think it worked, you know, in the past couple of years. And this year, it just seems wide open. So it's really gratifying to see that.
Well, I've spent a lot of time with art over the last 4 or 5 or 6 months trying to get a little bit more into it. I wrote a post for the Book Smugglers last year that kind of took a slightly deep dive into sort of the gender disparity in cover art. And that's where I discovered this Hugo disparity where we, you know, literally had three women ever that had been nominated, and not, I guess four women actually, because Julie Dillon was nominated last year, so it was four women as of last year that had been nominated ever, and not, I mean, they're all worthy nominees at the time, but not necessarily the four women that you would have guessed. I mean, you know, folks like Kanuka Craft and others that have got huge catalogs had never been nominated, which is just stunning.
The fact that Kanuka, I only just sort of realized that this afternoon, and that's shocking to me that Kanuka Craft has never been nominated.
And so, you know, as I look at all of these artists, there are just as many artists that are incredible that aren't on this list. And this is kind of one of those, there's just so much great work being done in the field that it's hard to pick how I would even nominate. I mean, on this list, I think only two of my nominees made it onto this list. And we'll see. I think you're right, Irene, that John Harris has kind of got he's not retiring, but he kind of has the Ginger Buchanan impetus, perhaps. Like, he's had this iconic style that's just been on so many iconic books, and the fact that he's never won is a little strange. So, you know, we'll see, but I do think there's a bit of a big push out there for Julie Dillon. And she's been very outspoken about the gender disparity in this category, and she's really tried to lead the charge on getting the word out about a lot of women artists. So I think there's gonna be a lot of support for her.
Definitely.
Okay, best semi-prozine, Apex Magazine, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, Interzone, Lightspeed, and Strange Horizons. I'm pretty familiar with all five of these. One of them, I think two of them are based in the UK, Interzone and Strange Horizons, I believe, are both UK-based. Might be wrong about Interzone, but I think it is.
Interzone is definitely UK-based. Okay. It's TTA Press. I did have a subscription to it once a long time ago, but it's the only paper-only magazine on the entire semi-prozine ballot this year.
Oh, wow, you're right. No.
It's actually paper-only? It's not online?
Well, I think you can get an online subscription, but it is paper. It's the only sort of traditional magazine-type thing, because Lightspeed is now online only.
Talk about a changing of the guard, which we'll talk about in the next category, too. Carl, are you familiar with these magazines? What do you think?
I'm familiar with their reputations, but I don't put enough time towards reading short fiction outside of Tor.com to have read very much of their lists. I think they all put out consistently, I'm not surprised to see any of these magazines up there. I do need to figure out what the word semi-prozine means before I can have a totally informed opinion.
I will tell you, and it basically means that nobody makes their living solely off the magazine. Like, nobody gets a salary from, you know, a living wage from the magazine. I think that's basically
it makes up no more than a quarter, I think. I think it's no more than a quarter of anybody's income.
Gotta think Lightspeed's bumping up on that floor.
I was just wondering about that, yeah.
But, I mean, the only two I'm really familiar with at all are Strange Horizons and Beneath Ceaseless Skies. And I have to say, I like Beneath Ceaseless Skies because they do that sort of second world fantasy.
Well, they have a great point of view, right? It's like that adventure fantasy.
Yes.
Like, it's fun. It's really the only market of these four that I would think has like a, this is a BCS story. Like, you know, when you're going to go to Beneath Ceaseless Skies, like, you kind of know what you're going to get. You're going to get that.
They have a much... I think it's not fair to call it a much narrower house style, but, you know, there's a much more predictable set of emotional reactions that you can expect from a BCS story, I think, personally. I mean, Interzone is really SF heavy, and Strange Horizons does sort of interesting things. I don't always like their fiction choices, but they're always interesting. And I'm not really familiar. I don't read enough in the short fiction to know much about Apex or Lightspeed at all.
Well, I dabble in this a lot here and there, just because I am so, you know, I spend a lot of time figuring out what the community is always talking about. So I do get into these. Lightspeed definitely has like a popular sort of feel to it. Strange Horizons, I think, is really kind of weird and experimental at times. One of the things I love about Strange Horizons is they do a lot of really cool nonfiction as well. I think they have some of the more interesting fanish commentary. Certainly Renee of Lady Business, who writes her fanish column there, I think does a really neat thing. And I think they're always actively trying to get sort of like really unique points of view out. So I nominated Strange Horizons. I will probably vote for them.
I mean, Strange Horizons. Apart from Interzone, the other magazines don't really do any sort of big. They don't have any sort of major sort of non-fiction capacity. And Strange Horizons does like a little bit of everything, which makes it sort of kind of odd.
I think interestingly odd. I think Lightspeed does a tiny bit of nonfiction, and also does a surprising number of reprints, but not to the capacity of Strange Horizons for sure.
Because I mean, I'm a bit biased, but I think the review section at Strange Horizons, not mine. I think I'm one of the worst, sort of less sort of academic reviewers who review for them. But they always have really sort of detailed, interesting perspectives on what they take. Abigail Nussbaum really does interesting things with the reviewer list, and Rebecca Cross with the columns. I confess that I don't actually enjoy the short fiction out of Strange Horizons much, but I reliably read their reviews and columns.
Maybe Irene has an interesting perspective on this, because Tor.com quite clearly has a very broad desires to have a very broad view of the fanish conversation, from, you know, book reviews to essays to rereads to fiction, now doing audio fiction. I mean, it really tries to do a little bit of everything, and I think there's value in that, in not being sort of narrow in your focus.
Oh, there's value in it. There's fun in it. We just enjoy it, you know, every piece of it. And there's definitely people that are fans of one thing and not the other. And I think that's sort of what makes the place fun.
Yeah, I think that's why I'll back Strange Horizons, simply because it's a prozine, semi-prozine. It's not semi-pro-fiction magazine. You know, I view it as somebody that's trying to do a lot of different stuff. And I think they're the ones to do that. And it'll also make the Hugo administrators have a headache, because they have submitted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 editors that will receive a trophy if they win. So just purely on volume.
They need lots of rockets.
That's right. They need lots of rockets. You know, here at Rocket Talk, we know about rockets. Okay, so best fanzine. I think there's a lot of cool stuff going on here. The Book Smugglers by Anna Grillo and Thea James. Dribble of Ink by Aidan Mower. Elitist Book Reviews by Stephen Diamond. Journey Planet by James Bacon, Chris Garcia, and a lot of other people. Porno Kitsch by Ann Perry and Jared Sharon. Liz, you read some of these regularly, right?
I read The Book Smugglers and Porno Kitsch regularly-ish. This is another category that's massively changed this year, because Journey Planet is the only sort of traditional paper zine on the ballot. And I don't think that was the case. I mean, it's 4-1. And I don't think that was the case ever before. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. And as a publisher of, Tor.com and a lot of blog posts that go up there, Irene, you have to sort of be encouraged by the fact that we're seeing bloggers being recognized for their work.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I think here in fan writer, like it's strange that, basically, nonfiction writing fits into a number of Hugo categories, but it's maybe not comfortably in any one category. So here's a nice place where just nonfiction writing is honored, and it is great to see that it's a medium that people can access and participate with very easily.
I mean, personally speaking, I'm very encouraged by the fact that The Book Smugglers are on the ballot, because they do things that. I mean, it represents this year's fanzine ballot represents a much sort of broader view of the different sort of discourses, if I can use that word, that are going on in the community. I mean, The Book Smugglers talks an awful lot about YA, some of which wouldn't fall into a speculative of sort of category, but they also talk about science fiction and fantasy and other things. And Porno Kitsch talks about a little bit of everything as well.
Yeah, they do. They do quite a bit of sort of pulp noir fiction, and yeah, so it is. It's a nice broad spectrum.
Yeah,
they do.
They do literary fiction. They do. Jared, in particular, adores like weird stuff from the early 20th century, late 19th century type stuff. Like, he's really into like Robert Chambers, for example.
Right.
Yeah.
Sort of the early, like the very roots of the genre, if you will, like the pre-genre stuff.
It just represents such a, I mean, much like the best related category, it represents just such a broad picture of what's going on. It's kind of great.
Do you track any of these blogs, Carl?
I get some of them sent through my Twitter feed, so I have to think that the inclusion of Cameron Hurley's We Have Always Fought gives a bit of a boost to A Dribble of Ink, since it premiered there. But I hear about all of these coming up, and that's...
He's done a tremendous job, though, over, particularly the past, you know, maybe year and a half, 2 years, I guess, of bringing in so many guest bloggers and different points of view and everything. So he's really, even beyond that one essay, he's really made a go of it.
Everybody on this list, it says edited by, but that's kind of crap. For the most part, they write it. You know, like Anna and Thea are writing The Book Smugglers, and it's really just them. You know, Porno Kitch is Anne and Jared writing, but Aiden doesn't write as much as he once did. I mean, he's really only himself writing substantive content maybe once or twice a month, where these others are writing every day. But what he's doing is he's going out there and he's actually functionally curating genre messages, and he's doing it in a way, I know for a fact that authors send him things and he tells them, no, rewrite it.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives them, I mean, he's editing nonfiction. He actually actively edits the nonfiction. And I think that's very interesting. I mean, I think he's almost running, and you'll notice that he just recently relaunched his site with ads. And I don't wonder if he may be finding himself in the best semi-prosing category next year. I will also point out that Porno Kitch has recently begun publishing fiction on their blog, and they will be a semi-prosing next year. So both Porno Kitch and A Dribble of Ink are, and The Book Smugglers also actually sell quite a bit of ad space as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if all three of these moving forward into the future are going to be moving up into a much more competitive environment above. So we'll have to see, you know, how that works out.
It's funny because they're sort of equally established. I think it's just one focuses on nonfiction and the other seems to focus more on, it should be like best fiction zine versus best nonfiction zine.
Yeah, I have to agree with Irene on that one.
Do you think it's possible that these zines moving up into semi-prosine might facilitate a kind of conversation about whether we need to move the categories?
I think it's possible. I certainly think that there will be a movement from the traditional fanzine crowd that's going to say, you know, it was all well and good. You know, they didn't like that blogs were being nominated in this category, but it was all well and good when it was just one, which was SF Signal, you know, sort of prior to last year. And now it's four blogs and one traditional fanzine. And given, I'll be very interested to see who just missed on this one, because it's quite possible that some other blogs, you know, just missed making this ballot. Certainly if SF Signal was eligible or had allowed themselves to be eligible, I'm almost sure they would have been on the ballot, and would that have pushed Journey Planet off? So, you know, I think the SMOF crowd, the Secret Masters of Fandom, or the World Science Fiction Society, if they will make a movement to split these categories, give blogs their own category, or give, you know, non-paper periodical magazines of a fanish nature their own category, I don't know. But I think this is definitely a shot across the bow, or a threat, or frankly, a natural evolution of what I've called, you know, traditional fandom becoming modern fandom. And there's always going to be some resistance to that change, but I think we've really hit a critical mass this year. I really do.
Yeah, definitely.
I will say I think Porno Kitch will win, because they are the primary UK-based blog. They are hugely involved. And, you know, Anne Perry is an editor at Hodder & Stoughton in the United Kingdom. She, you know, a Hachette SFF imprint. I think they just have a huge UK-based following. And, you know, we'll see. Aiden and The Book Smugglers have by far the largest audience, but on their blogs. But I think Porno Kitch will win. Anybody else?
I think it's wide open, because Journey Planet is edited by people who are also deeply involved in European fandom. So, and you have A Dribble of Ink and Book Smugglers with the audience. So...
Well, and does Journey Planet become the SF Signal? Does it become the counterculture vote?
Who knows? I mean, and I don't really read Elitist Book Reviews. I've got no idea what's going on down there. So It's I think it's a wide open category, which is really interesting. I'll be very interested to see who wins personally.
Yeah, I don't have a guess on this one.
All right, best fan cast. Are any of you big podcast listeners?
No.
Will you be mad if we say no?
No, it's fine. I won't be offended at all. I won't weigh in on this one. I weighed in on this on another podcast. I was on Skiffy and Fanti over the weekend. You can look up that podcast to hear my thoughts on this one, but otherwise we will just skip. Best fan writer, a little person called Liz Burke.
Woohoo!
Cameron Hurley, yeah. Foz Meadows, Abigail Nussbaum, and Mark Ashiro.
Am I allowed to talk about this category myself at all?
After That's we all just... talk about you.
Right, should I take my headphones off and stop listening?
No.
How would you know when to come back?
Well, I think we all obviously sort of, you know, we all have a bias in this category, perhaps.
At any rate, it's a very strong list, and of course we're very biased, and we feel rightfully so here for Liz, yay! But no, it's a strong list, and this is another one that I think whoever wins is going to be very interesting.
I think what's blowing me away about it is that I think a lot of people put down Liz, Cameron, Foz, and Abigail on their ballot, all four of them. And I think, I know I did, and I think a lot of people did that hoping that one of them would make it. They didn't know who the group would be backing, you know, which of these tremendously influential female writers is going to make the ballot. So I'm going to vote for all of them, nominate all of them in hopes that one of them will be, I'll pick one of them right. And I think that thought was so pervasive that all four of them made it, which is incredible, I think. And I feel sort of bad for Mark Ashiro because he's going to be forgotten constantly throughout this discussion, particularly because he's a repeater because he was here last year. I mean, what a cool thing for fandom. What a cool thing for the notions of gender disparity that have been talked about by these four in particular and others as well, but by these four in particular. I think it's a real great thing for fandom. A total wake-up call to the Hugo ballot at large, and hopefully continues to move forward. And the crazy thing about this, there are another half a dozen people sitting on the bench that totally deserve to be here too. You know, Aisha Submarinian, Renee, Jenny Thurman, Natalie Lurs, Jared Schurin, Ann Perry. I mean, there are just a ton of writers that any of them could have made this ballot, and I would have just been sitting here applauding. Just as I am for these this group.
You neglected to mention your own name in there, Justin.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Hopefully I'm number six and just missed the ballot. But I just think there are lots of tremendous writers. And it's awesome that we have so many people actively participating in this conversation. And I'm really gladdened by it. Liz, you can talk now if you want.
Well, I just wanted to point out, I think it might be one of the more international best fan writers in the awards history. I mean, Foz Meadows is an Australian living in, I think she's Australian, she's living in Scotland. Abigail Nussbaum is from Israel. I'm Irish. It was amazingly shocking to me to see my name on that ballot, because Cameron and Foz have just been on fire. And Abigail is a critical genius. There is her commentary on whether it is on film, television, or books is just always. I might not agree with her, but she's always so precise, so on point, and incisive. It's very humbling to be considered in this category. I haven't said anything nice about Mark because I haven't read his or listened to his stuff.
And I actually need to go do my due diligence and listen to Mark, and I want to go read him so I can actually have some thoughts about him. Anyway, Sleeps with Monsters is a great column, too.
It's pretty good.
Thank you, Justin. It's very sweet of you to say that.
Well, you've made me pick up a lot of... Actually, I will say that Liz is probably the person who most changed the way I read and write about what I read. And I came to fandom very late. You know, it was 2011 when I started blogging. And at the time, I was reading probably 90% men. Ideas about gender and the treatment of women and the use of sexual violence never occurred to me and never would have occurred to me if it hadn't been for reading Liz and getting to be friends with Liz and having her call me out a few times for my own biases and bad writing and reading. And I think that the work that she, I mean, I got that from Liz, but people got it from these other people as well. And I think that's so important. And I'm glad that we're recognizing it. So
honestly, I could say the same thing just working on the site and reading essays and everything. Yeah, absolutely. It's given even, you know, I've given a lot more thought to these issues because of Liz.
Anyway, thank you, Liz.
Thank you. I'm going to stutter off and blush, so I won't comment on the next for a little while.
Well, you have a minute because we're skipping fan artists, because all of us have agreed that we just don't know enough about these artists to talk about it. So we're going to move on to our last category, and that is the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer. We have, again, an incredibly diverse shortlist here. Wesley Chu, Max Gladstone, Ram Esnam, Sophia Samatar, Benjamin Sridhar. We have these five writers. Three of them are on their second year of eligibility. Gladstone, Nam, and Samatar, and Chu and Sridhar are in their first year of eligibility. Carl, what do you think about this one?
I am really looking forward to reading up on a lot of these people. I noticed all this year and for a lot of last year that Benjamin Sridhar is just blowing up, has a ton of short fiction out, especially for someone in her first year of eligibility. Sophia Samatar is, you know, has a nomination this year, so that's always good. I am personally, like, totally in love with Max Gladstone's work. And he's also unbelievably charming in person. I cannot rate the experience of meeting him highly enough. And I'm really looking forward to getting associated with Wesley Chu and Ram Esnam's bodies of work as well.
How many of these have you read, Liz?
I've read Max Gladstone's and some of Sophia Samatar's work and some of Benjamin Sridhar's work. I think Benjamin's the only person on the ballot who's been nominated entirely on the strength of her short fiction, which is kind of fantastic, which means, but alas, I think that means she's not going to be the John W. Campbell Best New Writer this year. But I haven't read Wesley Chu's or Ram Esnam's, though I have heard pretty much only good things about Wesley Chu and things about Ram Esnam that says he appeals to an awful lot of people who aren't me. But Gladstone is just, I mean, he's got three novels out. Well, he will have three novels out by the time the Yugos come around, by the time the Worldcon comes around. And he basically exploded out the gate with the kind of quality in his debut novel that a lot of people don't achieve until the maturity of their career. So
I agree with you. I think Max Gladstone is a tremendous writer. I've just started Two Serpents Rise, but I thought Three Parts Dead was the best debut I read last year, or close to the best debut I read last year. And I also have Full Fathom 5 and hope to get to soon.
Full Fathom 5, I mean, I count myself really lucky that I have been able to read it already, because it's better than his first two novels, and it is a great big poke in the eye with a big sharp stick to all the sort of naysayers in the diversity stacks, because I think pretty much all the major characters are women, then, and they are not all white cis straight women either.
All of the viewpoints are women, and only one of them is white. And it's not a monolithic whiteness in this world either.
No,
there isn't a monolithic racial presence.
No, and it's also such a fantastic reaction against the medievalist nostalgia strain in Second World Fantasy. He is unapologetically writing modern Second World Fantasy.
I feel like what he's done to some degree is take sort of the high concept, big idea textures that China Mieville has worked in and others that have sort of written in that weirder space, and sort of brought a more approachableness to it.
Yeah, and it's like he's married the best parts of urban fantasy to the new weird, and made and to thriller narratives, and set it in a absolutely fantastic, really interesting, in a really interesting setting that's, you know, full of massive potential.
Well, I've read both Nam and Chu as well, and I'm with you, Liz. I'm a huge unapologetic fan of Wesley Chu. It's sort of like watching a Jackie Chan movie. Like, you're not going to watch it and say, this is the best book I've ever read, but you're going to watch it and be like, man, I had a crap load of fun for the last 2 hours. And that's like what a Wesley Chu novel is. Like, he's just a lot of fun, and his novels have great pace, and he's actually got a new book that'll be out from Tor probably in 2015 that I've been lucky enough to already read. And he's going places, I hope, very much. And Ramez Nam, like, I get why people dig him. His really cool, big ideas. I mean, the whole concept of his first novel was, what if there was a drug that let people become empathic and, you know, can communicate mind to mind, and what the government would do with that and how they would react to it. And that's a cool idea, but it kind of read like a James Bond story to me. So I didn't love it, but I get why people really did.
And I mean, Sophia Samatar as well, her A Stranger in Alondria, her writing doesn't give me the same emotional response that an awful lot of other people seem to have had to it. But I mean, I can see why people, you know, feel very strongly about her first novel and her writing, because based on her voice and her talent and her technical skill, it's fair to mature into an important and influential voice.
Irene, do you have anything to say about Max Gladstone?
I have that publishing disease where, because I work on the books, I've read bits and pieces of them and never, you know, and then I have to move on to the next project I need. But I've only heard amazing things, and it's absolutely true that Carl is in love with Max Gladstone.
It's a little embarrassing.
I'll tell you, Carl, Irene and I were emailing back and forth one day, and I mentioned that I was going to have Max on the show, and she said, well, we're gonna have to see if we can get Carl on that show. He's been carrying around a dog-eared, tattered copy of Full Fathom 5 and waving it in strangers' faces.
I have been doing that, to be fair.
I can really understand that impulse.
Arcs also fall apart really quickly, but yeah. It's
I can really understand that impulse. I honestly think that on the strength of what he's already published and on, you know, his potential to do even better stuff in future. Because each of his three novels have just gotten better than the last one. Gladstone will take home the best new award. It will be strange to me.
Yeah, I liked Two Serpents Rise less well than Three Parts Dead because of some choices it made. But that isn't because it's a worse novel. It's because it's a more difficult novel, a more challenging novel. And Full Fathom 5, I believe, is more challenging yet, but is exactly as enjoyable as Three Parts Dead.
Yeah, it's... I mean, I read... Sorry, I... Go ahead.
I think that it's a proof that he's actually getting better and is not suffering at all from putting out a book every year. It's a cumulative experience.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with you. I didn't enjoy Two Serpents Rise as much as Three Parts Dead, because Three Parts Dead was made out of things that would hit my sort of narrative gleefulness, and so was Full Fathom 5. But Two Serpents Rise is structurally, I think it's a stronger novel than Three Parts Dead. So, yeah.
Well, so I guess if we went around and said who's going to win on this one, it sounds like a universal Max Gladstone here, at least in who we think should win. If I were going to hazard a guess here, if it's not Gladstone, I would guess Samatar will win this one. I think she has kind of the backing of the quote-unquote literary community, perhaps.
Yeah, I thought it was a toss-up between those two.
And I think the second year of eligibility is always really important on this.
Yeah.
And people tend to want to vote for that person that won't have a chance again. And the evidence shows that if you make that first year, you're pretty darn likely to make that second year. Certainly Gladstone was here last year, and Murr Lafferty was there two years in a row before she won. So just real quick, let's do some closing thoughts real quick about the ballot overall. I mean, are you happy with this ballot? Are there still some problems? Is this a freak-out ballot, or is this a good change is good ballot? Let's start with Irene.
Oh, I think it's definitely a change is good ballot. I mean, you know, the Vox Day thing is repugnant, but it's there and it got voted in. And but I think overall, I don't think that that taints the good stuff. And I think there's so much good stuff here. So I'm actually looking forward to this Hugo night more than I have in a long time.
Yeah, I'm with Irene. I mean, when the on the live stream, you could sort of. When they got up to the sort of novelette category, I was watching the live stream, and you could just sort of basically hear the what the WTF in the room and see it on Twitter. But it doesn't change the fact that this is quite. I mean, it's quite possibly the most sort of diverse, you know, Hugo list across all the categories that we've had yet. It's the one that's doing the most. Sort of most interesting things in best related, and even in the fan. I mean, there's seven entrants in the fan cast one, and the short stories are excellent. What I've seen of everything else, it's really interesting. I mean, it looks like a really interesting ballot, and the one thing that we can take away from what you referred to earlier as the sad puppy ballot. It's got more people involved in the award, so I'm not sure that, you know, getting more people to vote for a thing is ever really a bad thing. However much we may disagree with their voting decisions,
Carl,
I think it's necessarily both a freak out and a positive development. Like both elements are present in the ballot, but I think that can really only further the conversation that has been so gripping our community in the past year or two. It's ongoing, the pushback by the more conservative elements and the unflagging call for change from the more liberal elements. That's not going away. The ballot's not trying to sweep anything under the rug. And I think it'll be interesting to watch. I also think that the things that I find more palatable are going to win, so it gives me a more positive take on it.
Yeah. Can I just add something else?
You may.
It's the thing that I was extremely surprised to see Vox Day's name on the ballot, but the thing that's really comforting to me is how much everybody else is expressing their repulsion at his opinions, and it's not like people are shrugging their shoulders and saying, oh well, boys will be boys. It's more like, no, this guy's opinions are unacceptable, even if he is on the ballot, which is quite comforting.
Well,
in a sense,
I will merely sort of close with this thought that is. If you object to the points of view that are coming out from Vox Day and others, and I think we all clearly do, that the solution to these problems is to increase the voter pool. The more people that are participating will fix this. It will make it more representative. It will make voting blocks less impactful. It will make all of this a better representative of the genre as a whole. And so I would call on the World Science Fiction Society to strongly consider reducing the amount that it costs to be a nominating and voting member, a supporting member, to an amount that is more reasonable for people in the developing world, people not in the United States or the United Kingdom, and to people of lower incomes, where $50 is not insignificant. And if that number were closer to $10, I think we would see a much broader engagement in the fan community on this subject, and I think we'd have a better shortlist for it. That's what I would say. I think that's the solution to most of the complaints that we're seeing out there.
And I think it is on the agenda for the business meeting, right? Or I think it was at least talked about last year. I get confused about what the agenda is, but certainly that's part of the discussion.
Yeah. I've never really been to a Worldcon where I was already sort of involved in the conversation, so I've no idea how feasible, you know, lowering the supporting memberships are. I will note that just making something a purely popular award doesn't necessarily increase diversity. If you lower the entry to voting entirely, it doesn't cost anything to vote for the Legend Award, but we still got a rather similar, shall we say, slate of finalists this year. So it doesn't necessarily, I mean, greater participation doesn't necessarily fix things, but I don't really think, I mean, speaking as a sort of socialist type person, I don't really think lowering prices for things hurts.
Yeah, I guess what we'll say is that this is a complicated problem with no easy solution, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep trying to find one, right? So with that, this has been Rocket Talk's special episode on the Hugo Awards. And thank you all for being here.